It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios, once again, John Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, co-editors at Eat the State. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Hello.
How you doing? Busy week, huh?
Yeah. Well, actually, I've been sick in bed most of the week, which, of course, is where I was last week, too. But
Kind of a different kind of busy.
Yeah, I want to thank the Queen Anne Neighbors for Peace for, you know, taking all my germs away from me last night when I started. They're very inspiring folks, and I'm actually going and talking also. We'll talk about events to plug at the end of the program, but I'm giving a talk for the Wallingford Neighbors for Peace at noon today. So that'll.
Oh, very good.
I'm doing the tour of the local peace groups this week.
All right, and hopefully not.
And infecting them all.
No.
Biological warfare. We got a director from the White House to, you know, target the peace groups.
So, lots of stuff revolving around Iraq, of course. And one of those things, don't know how many people caught it, but on if you get cable, you get C-SPAN, then I've been watching the press conferences from the White House, both the White House with Ari Fleischer press conferences and the Defense Department.
Yeah, with Rumsfeld.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And they're very enlightened.
Rumsfeld is a treat, isn't he?
He is. He's something else, you know.
It's like, you know, you can imagine if Goebbels had press conferences in the 1930s. This is what they would look like.
It's probably pretty similar. So anyway, for those that have been, there's been some emails going around about Ari Fleischer's press conference talking about they spent a lot of time focusing on the quid pro quo of the U.S. for giving trade-offs for their votes at the UN on the Security Council.
To the various non-permanent members.
Right, and Ari kept trying to spin it that, no, this is just, these countries are just really doing the honorable thing that's got nothing to do with paying them off. And to their credit,
and my understanding is that Maria has not heard this. Is this
no,
correct?
I haven't heard this.
Okay.
All right. So so if you bear with me, we will play that segment, the very end, last question, and Ari getting laughed off stage, if that is okay with you.
Of course, in order to do this, Mike has had to lunge across the room with the cracked design of the KEXP studio here.
Yes.
Okay, I just had a technical problem. We're going to have to pass on this.
Okay.
Oh, well.
Darn it. And also,
well, for, since Maria had not
us,
heard
but...
this, yeah, the White House press corps, and this is like a total break with decorum, actually laughed Ari Fleischer out of the room when he kept insisting that, he just turned on his heels and walked out of the room. Because the entire press corps, once he kept denying this, it just erupted in laughter.
Mm-hmm. So he was basically saying, no, we're not offering bribes to
yes, it's just these countries
members.
All just want to do the right thing. They're just concerned about the Iraqi regime, just staying on message. And it really goes to show, I've been maintaining for a long, long time that the best way to respond to Bush and to R.A. Fleischer is with a laugh track. But when you have the White House correspondents, the people whose job it is to maintain a professional objectivity, which of course we can always talk about, but you know, part of that is the decorum and the respectable atmosphere of the White House, and it just really goes to show how little credibility these administration folks have, even with the people who cover them day in and day out.
Well, and you have to understand that some of these same correspondents are probably covering U.S. diplomats and British diplomats who traveled all over the world this week to Mexico, to Pakistan,
yes,
to
with big
Angola.
Suitcases of money.
Oh, yeah. And you look at countries like Pakistan, who is a major aid recipient from the United States. There's no way they're going to say no if the U.S. puts pressure on them. Same with Mexico. Mexico's waffling, doing the best they can to not say yes or no. They're hoping to be part of a group of U.N. Security Council members who want to abstain en masse from any vote on a UN resolution, but it's going to be really hard with the U.S. putting the screws
on. And so what you get with the dollar figures that are put out as to, you know, what the United States is paying to these different countries, that's only the half of it, because you also have the pressure of countries that are already receiving regularly scheduled payments for other things that are worried about the threats of that being withheld.
Right, and you also have, especially some of these African countries, their main sources of revenue come from trade with U.S. companies. Guinea, for example, extremely impoverished company, its main exports are mineral...
Country.
Its main exports are minerals that are sold to U.S. companies. So it's going to be really hard for them to say no when the U.S. comes knocking on their door saying, we want your vote.
Yeah,
it's the same with Angola.
Not that any of this should have anything to do with Saddam Hussein, but...
Right. It's the same with Angola. Angola just finished 30 years of war, and they need money pretty desperately to rebuild their infrastructure. Their main trade is oil. They're the second largest oil producer in Africa. That oil goes to U.S. companies largely.
All right. Well, let's move along. There was an article in Newsweek, I believe, this week that brought out some more information that apparently the U.S. and the U.K. had been holding back on. Pretty critical.
Yeah, Saddam Hussein's nephew, Hussein Kamel, defected from Iraq in 1995. He is widely considered the highest-ranking Iraqi official ever to defect, and he's often cited as the most credible source of information among Iraqi defectors. Now, he was interviewed by three groups of people, by the CIA, by British intelligence, and by UN inspectors. Newsweek managed to get a hold of the documents, notes taken by the head of the UN inspection team at the time, who interviewed Hussein Kamel. And he said in his interview to UN inspectors, and he also indicated that he had said the same thing to the CIA and to British intelligence, that Saddam Hussein had destroyed all of his chemical and biological weapons at the end of the Gulf War. I'll repeat that. He said that Saddam Hussein destroyed all of his chemical and biological weapons at the end of the Gulf War. Hussein Kamel is the man among Saddam Hussein's relatives who ran the chemical and biological weapons programs, so he should know. The UN has been keeping this a secret all this time, so has the CIA.
Not just the United States, but the United Nations itself
has been keeping this a secret.
Yeah.
Now you can say, well, maybe they just lost his interview among all the papers and documents that they have. However, the U.S. has been citing Hussein Kamel as its major source of information among Iraqi defectors on the chemical and biological weapons program. And you would think that Hans Blix, the head of the U.N. inspection team, once Colin Powell and the U.S. had cited him as its main source of information, would have gone back through his documents and found the interview with Hussein Kamel and looked at it to see, gosh, you know, what did he have to say? Because Kamel ran the program. He knew the specific sites that were used for chemical and biological weapons productions. He knew all the details about how they were funded and everything.
This is the guy who's the
main source.
Yeah.
And he told them all that information. There is no way that Hans Blix has not seen this interview material with this man.
Although there was an additional interview that he gave to a graduate student in California who later wrote it up. And never mind.
Don't get me sidelined here. So... You know, this really calls into question the credibility. I mean, this is an international scandal. It should be an international scandal. It calls into credibility not only the CIA. We know the CIA lies. They lied last week when George Tenet told the Senate committee that there was a direct link between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda, and then turned around minutes later and told reporters that there was no evidence of a direct link. We know the CIA lies, okay? But when the UN hides this kind of information, they don't even have to protect this source. I mean, Hussein Kamel is dead. He returned to Iraq when he found out that the U.S. was not going to overthrow Saddam Hussein in 1995 and install him as dictator instead. He returned to Iraq, and Saddam Hussein had him executed as a traitor. This man is dead, so there's no reason to protect him as a source anymore. And yet the U.N. has kept this information secret. Hans Blix has not used it as proof. It is proof. It is a piece of evidence, a very strong piece of evidence, that no biological and chemical weapon stocks exist and that they were destroyed, as the Iraqi government has been claiming all along. He's been hiding this information. So that calls into doubt the credibility of the current UN weapons inspections.
And what this really underscores also, the United Nations has been setting itself up as an institution of being sort of the credible objective mediator between the United States, who wants to go to war, and the, you know, the rest of the international community, basically, which does not. And so, you know, there's this public perception out there that the United Nations, well, if it eventually decides it wants to go to war, it must be a pretty serious matter after all. This, number one, calls into question the objectivity of the United Nations, whether or not it as a body overall, and certainly its inspections program, is being manipulated by the United States and the UK. And number two, it also calls into question the objectivity when it comes to other issues, such as member nations that are being bribed by the United States and how that might affect its vote. It really is a condemnation of the corruption of the entire process.
Well, and I think you have to separate, too, just like you do with the U.S., you have to separate the U.N. administration versus the United Nations as a body, you know. Just as with the U.S. administration, you have a U.S. administration doing one thing, and you have the U.S. populace wanting something completely different.
But what I'm talking about is the public perception of the and the international perception of the legitimacy of the United Nations as sort of a brokering body in this. Mm-hmm. That it really. To the extent that this is going to become a story in other parts of the world, and I don't know whether it is or not. I haven't seen it in the international press yet.
I haven't either.
but if it does, one of the things that it calls into question even further is whether the United Nations is an objective broker in all this either.
All right. Moving along, the U.S. Had been waiting for things to happen so it could flaunt another proposal. They keep coming out with proposals. I guess there's a proposal factory or something near the White House.
Well, there's a disinformation factory, actually. They're a product line, basically.
There were three proposals made before the U.N., this week. The first one was a U.S.-British resolution, the draft resolution, supposedly to allow the U.S. to go to war with Iraq, although if you read the draft resolution itself, it reads like it's a document. It's a Swiss cheese document. It's full of holes. Basically, it was written to appease Spain and Britain, and so it looks like it was written and then rewritten and then rewritten and then rewritten again, and it certainly reads that way. It's a ridiculous document. It is 9/10 preamble, and it has one sentence of resolution, and the one sentence says, let's see here, it says, decides that Iraq has failed to take the final opportunity afforded to it in Resolution 1441, period. Makes no mention of material breach. It mentions it in the preamble, but the preamble simply reiterates earlier resolutions. It talks nothing about war or force or anything, and that was a concession to Spain and Britain. It was to allow Spain and Britain to vote for this resolution and then be able to turn around and tell their populace that they had not actually voted for war.
Yeah, and you know, there's a tremendous amount of sort of euthanasia of language going on here and whitewashing all the way through the process to avoid anybody calling this what it is, basically, which is the premeditated murder of a large number of civilians, the unprovoked premeditated murder of a large number of civilians, which is something that runs contrary to international norms, international law, all the way down the line. It's not something that most countries of the world are comfortable signing off on. It's not something that most people in the media are comfortable talking about. So, everybody is really agreeing to look the other way, and you see that in this document also.
You really do. You really do. In contrast is the Franco-German memo. They call it a memo. It's not really a draft resolution per se, although it could become a draft resolution if there was the least bit of wavering on the part of Britain and Spain and the U.S. Now, that memo is actually very, very detailed and takes steps towards disarmament. It calls for defining a program of action for the inspectors, which would then give Iraq some idea of what it needs to do to comply to disarm. It would provide. It calls for providing additional support for the inspectors. It also asks the inspectors to report to the council every 3 weeks, and then it would require them to make a full progress report in 120 days, and that would be about 4 months from the time when this would become a resolution that was adopted. So it's a very common sense, practical document, and it makes the U.S. document look extremely ridiculous in comparison.
Yeah, the United States actually has preempted some of that, I guess just yesterday. And again, you know, Ari Fleischer sort of talks in circles, so nobody's exactly clear what he, on behalf of the president, was saying. But it appears that they're saying at this point that they don't care whether Iraq disarms or not, that if Saddam doesn't go, they're going to invade. It really has gotten to the point where the United States has clearly made its decision. It's going to invade. They would like to have the fig leaf of international support. And, you know, if they don't, then they'll just flaunt international support.
The PI this morning, their headline, I hope I'm remembering it correctly, was U.S. seeks regime change, which you can kind of take a couple different ways.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's reflecting a hardening of positions on the U.N. Security Council. They can't come to any middle ground, and so they're moving further and further apart. Russia announced that it would veto this British UN resolution, and then the U.S. is basically retaliating, saying, well, we not only want Saddam Hussein to disarm, we want regime change too.
Yeah, and apparently Bush and Vladimir Putin, the warm, cuddly grandfather of the Russian people, and Bush got into a shouting match on the phone yesterday over this. It was, it's been very, Russia, like most any other country, does not want to see an unchecked United States that does whatever it likes without regard to international consequences. It's very understandable.
So there's been a lot of talk, and even the press continues to ask at these press conferences about the estimates of the cost of the war, the coming war. And, Rumsfeld, I was watching him yesterday, you know, that he was just dancing around this, just kept, and Paul Wolfowitz were like, well, you know, we have these ranges, and they'd say, well, give us the ranges, you know, and they'd say, well, it would really be unfair to give you a range at this point.
And you know perfectly well that they have studied this to death, and tried to account for every paperclip, and the only reason they're not forthcoming with the information is that the figures are not what they want.
Well, and there are some variables because they're busy bribing these countries that sit on the UN Security Council. That's making the cost go up and up and up, and they don't want you to know how much is making the cost go up.
And the cost of reconstruction is also a huge variable, depending on how much they destroy.
Right, and so they're looking at a cost range of between somewhere between $61 billion to over $100 billion just for the war. And they're not talking yet even about the reconstruction costs and the ongoing costs of stationing troops in Iraq. And I think it's interesting that Lawrence Lindsay, the White House economic advisor, had estimated the cost to be about $200 billion at the minimum a year ago, and he was laughed at and ridiculed, and he was actually, I believe, fired for that position. He resigned, but I believe he was booted out because he had made that cost estimate so high.
Yeah.
And then you had Rumsfeld turn around and say, oh, no, it's only going to be $40 billion. Well, you know, that's doubled, and then it's probably going to double again.
Yeah, a few billion dollars here and there. And mind you, we're talking about this for a war that may actually only last, in terms of a formal shooting war before American troops are in Baghdad, of a few days. It is an enormously expensive undertaking for which there's really been no reasonable accounting from the government, from an administration that spends money like it doesn't matter.
Mm. And, of course, we're just talking monetary costs here. We're not talking costs in lives.
Right. Oh, no, we wouldn't want to get into that kind of thing. Well, as you may have heard, there will be no civilian casualties in Iraq, where we have very intelligent bombs that are only going to seek out every square inch of the country that is not populated by a human being.
So, tied into that, General Shinseki this week gave some estimates that caught him a lot of
fire.
This is not a retired military guy. This is not a low-level flunky at the Pentagon. This is the Army's top general in charge. Now, he said before a Senate Armed Services Committee that governing post-war Iraq will take several hundred thousand troops in order to maintain security and to govern the country. Now, he didn't say a couple hundred thousand, which is what you would expect if it were, like, say, 200,000, he was thinking. He said several hundred thousand. There's only a couple hundred thousand over there right now to conduct the war. So this is a major, this is also a major story. I mean, the Pentagon immediately said, oh, no, 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 that's not true. And Donald Rumsfeld said, oh, no, 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 it's going to be far less than that. But he said the same thing about the cost of the war.
And let's review also, this is strictly talking about Iraq. One of the threats in the quote unquote worst case scenario with this war, which I think is actually the likeliest case, is that American troops and American civilians are going to be targets all over the Islamic world. And, you know, I want to talk about the Philippines if we have any time a little bit later, but you're going to have more and more of these troop commitments all over the Islamic world that will be called part of the overall war on terror, but will be pretty much directly traceable to responses to the provocation of the U.S. invading Iraq.
Yeah, one of the people I saw speak this week was Hamid Karzai, and he was saying he was very concerned about if the U.S. goes into Iraq, that it's going to be pretty much leaving Afghanistan open, wide open for trouble. So moving along, you have a draft list of war crimes that the Pentagon has worked up?
Yeah, the Pentagon has put out a draft list. This is in conjunction with the military tribunal system that President Bush set up fairly soon after the beginning of the 9/11 and the war on terror, by which the Pentagon and the military will prosecute people. And these are the so-called enemy non-combatants that are being held and tortured and mistreated at Guantanamo Bay and various other locations around the world and with various other unsavory regimes. And it could also apply, interestingly enough, to members of the Iraqi military and hierarchy that might be captured in a war against Iraq. A list of what potential war crimes these folks can be charged with. And it's very interesting because that's a document that specifically says that this is for non-citizens. This is a document that will be used to apply the war on terror to military tribunals, which will be used for non-citizens. Well, as we talked about a few weeks ago, there's also something called the Domestic Security Enhancement Act of 2003, more popularly known as the sequel to USA Patriot, USA Patriot 2. One of the more onerous provisions in that document, full of them, is that citizens who are detained or declared to have, they don't, of course, have to actually face trial, we've already established that, of aiding and abetting in the war on terror can be stripped of their citizenship, again, by the federal government without any necessarily due process. And so what you have then is the government saying that we can take a citizen, strip him of his citizenship, and these are the list of the war crimes that we can have that recent ex-citizen also be declared. So this really can apply to just about anybody that the government says that it can apply to. That's one interesting aspect of it. There are 24 of them, and it ranges from the sort of things that you would expect, things like mass murder, all the way down to it has rape, and it has use of poisons, which I thought was interesting. The deaths of civilians. I mean, yeah, these are all things that could very easily be said to apply to the U.S. in Afghanistan or prospectively in Iraq, and it gets down to the sublime in some cases, such as the use of treachery or perfidy. I mean, that's something that Ari Fleischer does every day, for example. It's if anybody ever wants to haul him up on charges, or the degrading of the degrading treatment of a dead body, which you might think in certain Muslim circles that shoveling people into mass graves or incinerating whole cities might be considered degrading treatment. But so it's interesting that they're circulating this in public sort of as part of the show of, number one, how transparent the whole process is, and then also to reassure people that these really are nasty crimes. But we've already seen that relatively ordinary acts can be twisted to meet the definition of nasty crimes. So in some ways it can be treated not just as a declaration of what the U.S. wants to do overseas, but also as part of the domestic war on terror.
And of course, we see these the same list, the same incidents happening currently in other spots in the world, and the U.S. doesn't seem to bat an eyebrow over it.
Well, not only that, but the U.S. has been refusing to go along with the international war crimes system that's been set up to deal with some of these same issues in other countries because it worries that American soldiers and an American military command, including civilian leaders...
Right, and American diplomats.
Yeah, might fall under the definition of many of those crimes.
All right, real quickly, let's brush upon the situation in the Philippines.
Yeah, I mentioned that a little bit earlier. There's been a really interesting kind of standoff that's been going on over this past week. Actually, it's been brewing for quite some time over the deployment of U.S. troops in the Philippines. Now, it's under this sort of rubric of, the Joint Command Force of Southeast Asian countries that will be cooperating in the war on terror. But basically, what it's talking about is U.S. military personnel going in to assist Filipino military personnel in their campaign in various islands in the South Philippines against Abu Sayyaf. Is that how it's pronounced?
Abu Sayyaf bandits. They're often called the Abu Sayyaf guerrillas, and many experts believe that they really are more a bandit group.
Yeah, the U.S. has been trying to make the case for a long time that they're part of the Al-Qaeda network, and it's only in the very, very loosest of senses that they can even be linked. There are any number of good domestic reasons why the Filipinos would like to see this group suppressed. And so, they're talking, and Rumsfeld is talking about, we want to eliminate this group. Well, you're not likely to eliminate groups that spring up for religious and economic reasons, which is basically what they're about.
And in fact, Abu Sayyaf has stopped operating in the areas where they were operating, but they've moved to other islands.
Yeah.
They're just chasing them around.
So it's a snark hunt, really, is what it comes down to. The U.S. was in there last summer doing what it called training exercises, which, that's used as a cover for a lot of different things. But it wanted to go in there and have U.S. troops actually fighting openly alongside Filipino troops for this coming campaign this spring and summer. And unfortunately, there's this tiny provision in the Philippine Constitution that prevents foreign troops from fighting in the Philippines. And this is delicately referred to by Donald Rumsfeld as their situation, as though, constitutional law is something that just has to be handled. It's probably how the Bush administration feels in general.
Kind of like when a woman finds herself pregnant and it was an accident, just kind of like a little situation that just happened.
There you go, yeah. So they're busy trying to work out this compromise. You had Rumsfeld talking about how they were ready and going into fight, and then the Philippines were going, oh, no, because there was a domestic fear back home. So you've got this split, and then you've also had a very interesting whitewashing of history going on in media accounts of this. The New York Times in particular has had a couple stories in the last couple of days, I think, actually, that talk about the cultural sensitivities, particularly in the south of the country, toward having foreign and particularly U.S. troops there because of the alleged massacres of Filipino families, and particularly Muslims in islands like Jolo, that happened in 1898 when the Philippines was handed over from colonial Spain to becoming a colony of the United States. Well, that's not quite true on a couple of counts. Number one, it was not an alleged massacre. It was a massacre. Tens of thousands of people died, most of them women, children, and other civilians.
And it was not the Spaniards who did that.
And
it was
secondly,
the United States.
Yes, it was the United States that did that. And the circumstance was that the Philippines decided to declare their independence from Spain. Spain decided to go ahead and let them, and the United States decided in the race to have colonies, it got in late, it wanted colonies of its own. So it went in, massacred a bunch of Philippines, and took control of the country for 50 years. So it wasn't handing over from one country to another, it was invading an independent Philippines, which the Filipinos remember, the United States apparently does not.
All right, and some events coming up this week. One of them involving FCC is coming to town and going to be at the University
of Washington. Yeah, there's a huge hearing this week around FCC deregulation of media ownership rules. It's been in the works for several months. It's something big broadcasters and big corporations want. Michael Powell, the deregulation head, son of Colin, that has been pushing this, was going to have no public hearings. Public pressure forced one in Richmond, Virginia, and then additional public pressure a dissident commissioner, Michael Kopp, scheduled two more in different parts of the country. One of them will be in Seattle, one of only two in the country. That will be this coming Friday at UW Hub Auditorium all day long from 9 to 5. There will be alternative workshops and speaking going on, too. I don't know whether there will be public testimony or not. It's not clear on the format of it yet, but people should turn out, express their desire to not see a further erosion of diversity in the commercial media landscape. A couple other quick events that I wanted to mention. As I said before, I'm giving a talk at noon today for people who want to hear more of this Iraq nonsense. At noon at St. Benedict's Church for the Wallingford Neighbors for Peace. That is free. And then 7 o'clock tonight, Paul Loeb, author of Soul of a Citizen, a good friend that I've been working with on a piece on where the peace movement goes if an invasion starts. He's giving a talk on citizen activism in troubled times, Peace and Justice Alliance, I believe, at St. Mark's Cathedral at 7 o'clock.
All right. Well, with that, we have all of 30 seconds. Talking with John Parrish and Maria Tomchick, co-editors at Eat the State. And if you could just give the contact info for Eat the State.
Phone number is 206-903-9461 or www.eatthestate.org.
Very good.
And it's a great issue this week.